Well, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome once again. We're about to have a conversation with Dr. Teresa Runstetler. She's an assistant professor of American Studies at the State University of New York at Buffalo and has written this book that really, as soon as I saw the cover, I went, Jack Johnson. And I love Jack Johnson and the history built around him. And this book is called Jack Johnson, Rebel Sojourner, Boxing in the Shadow of the Global Color Line. And Teresa, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
So Jack Johnson, I mean, let's take a step backwards, though. I mean, there are many people who do know who he was, who have this kind of broad sense of an early American, African-American heavyweight boxer who ran around with white women and wore flashy clothes and drove fast cars.
That's a typical story, yeah.
Right? But so that's our image of Jack Johnson. And never in a historical context or a societal context, which is you tried to paint. But just for a few sentences here for a moment, describe your Jack Johnson.
Well, my Jack Johnson, he did run around with white women and he did wear flashy clothes. So that was certainly part of his persona. But what I try to do in the book is really explain the larger context in which he lived, which was one of not only Jim Crow segregation in the United States, but also Western imperialism really around the world. And so my Jack Johnson is somebody who fought against white supremacy on all fronts and in all places that he traveled, and he traveled very extensively.
And that to me, a couple of things you just mentioned here, let's explore in some depth. And one of the things that you try to do here, you don't try to, that you do here in this book, is to kind of make this connection between what was happening in the world with Western, let's say, white imperialism around the white domination in literal terms around the world of countries in Africa, Asia, Latin America, the ending of Reconstruction and the beginning of segregation in America, and how boxing in this fit into that, and the fears of black folks played all through this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, boxing was part spectacle and part sport. And for many people around the world, it represented, you know, people who were these kind of archetypal figures who were coming together to fight it out in the ring. And, of course, in the case of Jack Johnson, he carried the weight of not just black America, but also people of color throughout the colonized world on his back every time he went into the ring. And so anytime he fought a white fighter, it was looked at in a kind of social Darwinist way as a battle of the survival of the fittest. And of course, Johnson won many times. And so this was seen as a real affront to a lot of white supremacist theories that were undergirding, white man's burden and various theories of Western imperialism at that time.
And what was going on at that time? We're talking about a period in the 1890s, early 1900s. And so the way you describe it, I mean, one of the things you describe in your book, I think when you talk about early on in the book, when you look at the period of time we're talking about, you talk about a period of time when all these exhibitions were going on around the world, that blackface minstrel shows were happening, the Wild West shows were going on, and you talk about this kind of new entertainment industry that grew up, the glorification of brute force, and what was an interesting term you use here, the growing trade in white supremacist entertainment and the expansion of mass culture that you thought were pivotal in the construction of the color line. Let's explore that a minute. I mean, that's because these are the pieces of history we don't talk about. I mean, the connections you made about the rise of modern Western popular culture and race and the intersection there. I mean, describe your theory with that.
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, one of the things that I start out with in the book is W.E.B. Du Bois's idea of a new religion of whiteness that was literally sweeping the earth as he saw it. And that basically meant that various types of segregation, whether it was racial segregation or immigration restrictions, were really sweeping the earth from the 1890s really into the beginning of the 20th century. And one of the things that we don't think about is how pop culture, and in particular sport, actually played a role in spreading what Du Bois called the new religion of whiteness to ordinary people. Because in order for these imperial conquests to actually work, you had to have regular people, you know, people who went to the theater, people who went to watch sporting events, actually buy into the kind of racial ideologies that justified imperialism. And so one of the ways that this happened was through things like World Fairs, which were basically celebrations of imperialism, where often they would have people of color in almost like a human zoo on display for largely white consumers to view. And boxing worked in very much the same way, because for a long time, you know, the boxing ring was segregated, and the world championship, particularly the world heavyweight championship, was segregated with only white fighters. But one of the things that helped to make Jack Johnson and really propel him into international stardom was the fact that, you know, when he got into the ring against white fighters, it became, again, this sort of rehearsal of social Darwinism that people enjoyed watching. Unfortunately for them, it didn't quite work out because Jack Johnson usually beat his white opponents. But certainly there's definitely a link between the rise of mass culture as we know it and, you know, these larger sort of racial common sense that in some ways we still hold today.
Yeah, I mean, you, one of the things you do explore here in depth are kind of the roots, I mean, and the, almost the, really, when you read, look at the cartoons that you have unearthed, and I will read some of the quotes during the course of our conversation that you have uncovered about people of color written by white journalists and white sports journalists throughout the early part of the 20th century. I mean, they are just so blatantly, not just blatantly racist, but they just fit into the whole kind of the theories that were being created to prove that black folks were less than white folks and the all that was going on. It was very intense. I mean, because what you unearthed was something that people read every day in the papers. You know, so I mean, you unearthed some very powerful kind of lessons for us about what people really thought.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it was so ubiquitous that, you know, people weren't sort of thinking that it was shocking at the time. This was just everyday portrayals of people of color. And one of the things that I found so interesting about the Jack Johnson story was that no matter where he traveled, whether it was to London, England, or to Paris, France, or to Sydney, Australia, the depiction of him and the depiction of people of color was remarkably the same. And so you would find the same kinds of minstrel stereotypes of the, you know, the chicken-eating, watermelon-eating black American with the kind of Sambo-like face with the white lips and white eyes against a black background. And this was, you know, in newspapers and in boxing magazines and in sporting magazines, really all over the world. And it really goes to show how these images traveled right along the same route as mass culture and imperial power and military power. And it helps to explain in a lot of ways why our ideas about black inferiority and white supremacy, no matter where you go in the world, are surprisingly similar.
Very similar. And we're going to explore some of the similarity. Now, here we have Jack Johnson, who had begun his career and become already very famous and infamous because of his girlfriend who was white, his wife who was white. We're talking about the early 20th century, 1904, 1905, for a black man to openly engage with a white woman was like he was like standing up to something in a way that was unheard of. I mean, what that symbolism meant to the black world, what that symbolism meant to the world, to the white world, was just, I don't even know what word to use.
Yeah, I mean, it cut against, again, everything that was so tightly held in terms of theories of white supremacy. The idea that white bodies were, you know, above black bodies and that they shouldn't be contaminated by black bodies. And so in a lot of ways, what Johnson was doing in the ring in terms of beating white male bodies, was being mirrored outside the ring in the ways that he, you know, had relationships with white women. And most people know about his Mann Act conviction, which happened May 14th, 1913, when he was basically convicted by federal authorities for allegedly bringing his white girlfriend across state lines for the purposes of prostitution or debauchery. But there's other cases, for example, in South Africa, where the thought of him winning and the thought of that film of that fight getting to South Africa would actually exacerbate existing problems of black men raping white women. They called it the Black Peril. And a similar example in Australia, even before his Mann Act conviction, where he had a relationship with a young Australian woman named Lola Toy. And this caused a huge uproar once news of it was printed in the Australian press. And poor Lola Toy, you know, had things thrown at her in the street, people basically sending her hate mail, to the point where she actually had to sue the newspaper for libel, and she eventually won. So this wasn't just a kind of isolated phenomenon in the United States, but it actually was really protecting white women was a main tenet of white supremacy on a global scale.
And let's talk about, so Johnson in 1906 leaves San Francisco, from San Francisco, and goes to Australia. This is important, I think, to describe, as you began to a moment ago, what happened to him in Australia. I was about the Burns Johnson fight, and what I found very interesting was the whole Colored Progressive Association and what race meant to Australia.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The Colored Progressive Association, I actually found out about it through an Aboriginal scholar named John Maynard, and his grandfather, Fred Maynard, had actually attended a farewell party for Jack Johnson, because Jack Johnson, when he came to Australia, became a kind of iconic figure for people of color down under, and the Colored Progressive Association was made up of West Indian and other Afro-Caribbean sailors, and also African-American sailors and stevedores, and several Aboriginal dock workers as well. And they threw a party in honor of him, and it became one of the ways for them to actually speak out against what was then called the White Australia Policy, which was basically a series of statutes that were put in place to try and prevent the entry of people of color, for the most part, Chinese workers, from coming into Australia. And so he became this kind of figure, not just in terms of his ring victories, but also what, his status as world champion, or actually at that point he wasn't even world champion, but as a, you know, a black fighter who really just didn't put up with anything. He became this really big figure for people of color in Australia.
But when he beat Burns, Australia turned against him. There's this quote you have in here from the Australian, a newspaper, an editorial. In a population where the Negro is not an ugly, ever-present problem, as in the United States, it is possible to concede that there was a justification for the manifestation of this feeling. I mean, the hatred. I mean, I am not a sympathizer with colored people. I hate them. And I should die of disgust if I had to sit in the same compartment of a tram or tram with one. I mean, this was and he saw it as well. I mean, this is because he tried to some ways see the world outside the U.S. as less racist. But every time he did, he was hit in the face with it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the interesting thing is that when he went to Australia, and he wrote about this in his first autobiography, which was actually published in France, he talked about the fact that, you know, in Australia, I'm probably not going to have to be greeted with a color line. And Australians at the time, when he came in 1907 for his first trip, you know, said, you're not going to face a color line here. But ultimately, when he beat Tommy Burns, you know, that really flipped the script. It put white supremacy and the hypocrisy of white supremacy on display in Australia at a time when there were, you know, they were facing issues in terms of being what they like to call themselves as the lone white outpost in the Pacific. You know, their worries about the rising power of Japan, their worries about the influx of Chinese workers onto what they wanted to be a white continent, and then also the continued dispossession of Aboriginal people. And so the Jack Johnson fight and everything that he represented in terms of being a very defiant, kind of in-your-face, powerful black man really, you know, put those things front and center in terms of, you know, white Australia's attempt to remain a white nation.
It did that for almost every nation on the planet, whether it was South Africa or Australia or Britain. They were all threatened by this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, even a few years later in 1911, Jack Johnson goes to London, England, hoping that he's going to find this kind of civilized paradise. You know, he went to the coronation of King George V and saw the marching of soldiers of color in the capital of the British Empire and thought, well, okay, maybe this is the place where I should be. But then as soon as news of his fight against Billy Wells came out in the news, England quickly shifted its position. And to make a long story short, Winston Churchill, who was the Home Office secretary at that time, actually declared the fight illegal. Because they didn't want to see the British imperial champion, a white man, and also a former British Indian Army soldier, being beat by an unruly black American right in the heart of the British Empire.
I mean, and this did terrify them. You have some great quotes in here. Let me just – this was one that was written actually by I believe, a black editorialist, and if you'll remember the name, I didn't see the name, but here it is. There seemed to lurk – this took place in England after the Wells fight. And they said, there seemed to lurk a fear that the Negro all over the land would feel his ability to meet the white man on an equal footing, an African-American editorial writer, you quote. But no amount of suppression of what transpires on such occasions can stifle that inherent knowledge of manhood, which every Negro knows is within him. So, I mean, the idea that how, with all the political struggles that we have to fight for equality in this country and around the world, there are these moments, there are these cultural moments that seem to cross a line that empower and instill something in people that's beyond the body politic itself.
Yeah, and absolutely, it opens up these spaces where people can come out publicly and say what, you know, what they've been saying in conversations in private and in secret. So not that, you know, people didn't understand their own humanity and their own manhood before Johnson actually, you know, beats white men in the ring, but rather his beating of white champions actually opens up a public space for people to come out and really declare their sense of racial politics and their sense of their fight for racial justice.
I mean, and it was everywhere. I mean, the South Africans who had just made their – the Afrikaners and Brits who had just finished their wars with one another, declaring South Africa a white country. These battles that Johnson were fighting around the globe terrified them in terms of what it said to Native Africans in South Africa.
Oh, yeah. And in particular, I mean, getting back to the earlier comments about the relationship between the rise of mass culture and ideas of race globally, what they were particularly afraid of was the fact that telegraph communication was now, you know, very commonplace, so people could get information from abroad. The newspaper reports were coming in, so the press had expanded quite considerably, and they were printing pictures of Jack Johnson's various victories. And most importantly, the early film industry was really taking off in the early 1900s. And one of the things that really sparked the ire of white South Africans was the fact that there was a potential for Jack Johnson's defeat of Jim Jeffries, who at the time was the undisputed white world champion, that this would somehow infiltrate their carefully constructed racial order in South Africa and completely disrupt things.
And that, I mean, what you described there, I think, is something that you have a whole chapter on the controversy around the film of the Jim Jeffries-Jack Johnson fight. That was a huge explosive issue. I mean, from President Roosevelt to everybody across Europe was involved in that controversy over that film, over Johnson's winning. People didn't think he did win. Then they realized he did win. And just the fear that happened when this film was shown, let's say in Jamaica, South Africa, when black folks around the community of color around the world would see this film, what it did. This is huge.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. And, I mean, they weren't just afraid of the film. I mean, what's so surprising and so shocking for us today is that they didn't even want the fight film posters to be shown outside of the theaters. There was this sense that if they were to see Jack Johnson, a black man, victorious, you know, in a physical contest with a white boxer, that this would basically disrupt the kind of delicate balance that had to be held in places like South Africa, where white people, white settlers, were really the minority. And therefore their rule was always threatened.
And the context of this also, just going backwards for a moment and kind of bringing us back to the early part of the 20th century before Johnson comes back to the United States and why he fled. We'll get to that. But we talk about an era, as you describe, and I never thought about it, so it was one of those few sentences you wrote about, that we're talking about an era that started with this Italo-Ethiopian War and the Russo-Japanese War, where two nations of color beat Europeans. And there was a panic about that, and this, and especially with the rise of colonialism. I mean, there was a tenor of the earth at that time where Jack Johnson walked in the middle of that, and that's why he became such a dangerous character for them.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that, you know, has persisted in terms of the kind of Jack Johnson legend that's popularly told is that, you know, he brought all of this negative response on himself. That, you know, if he hadn't been so unruly outside of the ring, if he just hadn't, you know, dated white women, that somehow people would have just left him alone and he could have been champion and been a positive champion. But when you start to look at the larger context in which he fought, the fact that people were, you know, palpably anxious about whether or not in the 20th century white supremacy would still prevail, you recognize that it wasn't just about Johnson as a person, that it was actually the efforts to contain him were really about white authorities, whether in the United States or across the British Empire or in France or wherever it might be, trying to figure out how to, you know, keep a hold on their power over people of color throughout the colonies. So it was really much more than just his sort of idiosyncratic personality. It had to do with these larger events, which he got swept up into, and in many cases didn't necessarily want to be swept up into them, but had to reckon with them at the same time and come out with his own opinion about them.
So how do you think that this era and what that during Jack Johnson's era in the early 1900s through time when he came back to America, we'll talk about that, and went to prison and came out, how our culture, the culture that was developed then, the American culture, the mass culture developed then, how it affected where we are now?
Sorry, could you ask that again?
Sure. I'm just thinking about the culture that you talk about that was erupting around the world, that was this kind of white supremacist entertainment of that part of the early part of the 20th century, and as you write about the regeneration of the white body politic at that period of time, kind of redefining and defining culture, the beginning of film and all the rest that was going on, the popularity of boxing that exploded and has been that way maybe up until like 15 years ago. How do you think that period defined culture in terms of race in the world we are today? What do those roots say about where we are now?
Well, I mean, that's a huge question, but let me try and take a stab at it. That's another book that one could write.
Yes, I think it is. I don't expect you to write it now.
Be my next project. Well, I think one of the things that it shows is the fact that these, you know, there's been a lot of, let me just give you one example.
Sure.
There's been a lot of talk nowadays, especially in the wake of Euro 2012, about, you know, racism in Europe rearing its ugly head in places like Ukraine and Poland where Euro 2012 was happening. Or, you know, stories about Mario Balotelli and the fact that he's forcing Italy to come to terms with the influx of immigrants of color from Africa in particular. And one of the things that you can learn from this earlier point in history is that, you know, these sort of arbitrary ways in which we divide off racial problems into these sort of neat national categories just doesn't work. And that, in fact, these histories of racism as a global phenomenon are really, you know, coming to the surface even today through things like soccer, through things like racist tweets about hockey players. And so we can't really sort of sit in our, you know, national homes and point fingers at other places and castigate them for, you know, racism without turning it back on ourselves and asking ourselves how are we also culpable in the persistence of these racial ideologies that really came out of that moment of, you know, global culture in the early 20th century.
When Johnson comes back to America, he decides to come back to the United States. After he fled, he went to Europe the second time because he fled because of this arrest he had under the Mann Act. Describe that and what happened to him when he came back. I think even though that's not the center or heart of your book, I think we shouldn't leave that out.
Yeah. Well, Jack Johnson was convicted on May 14th, 1913, actually almost a century ago, for violating the Mann Act. And instead of staying to serve out his 366-day prison sentence and pay his $1,000 fine, he actually went into exile. He escaped through Canada and then went to France. He spent some time in Europe. He also spent some time in the Americas, everywhere from Barbados to Argentina, Mexico, and Cuba. And actually, interestingly enough, Jack Johnson's visits to a lot of these places helped to spark the rise of local boxing industries in different places. And he eventually, after 7 years, decides to come back across the U.S.-Mexico border and surrender. Now, interestingly enough, he ends up still having to serve his prison term in Leavenworth Penitentiary. So he's in a federal prison. And all the while that he's in prison, he was writing letters to various authorities, trying to seek clemency, trying to get pardoned, making the argument that he was innocent, and that this was just a malicious attempt to bring him down based on, you know, racism. But he never gets a response. And even today, 2004, Ken Burns and a multiracial and bipartisan coalition started working on a campaign to pardon Jack Johnson for his unjust conviction. And even now, it's 8 years later, and he still has yet to be redeemed many, many years after his death. And so, you know, it really shows in a lot of ways how we haven't been able to come to terms with the larger meanings of his legacy, because he was such a complicated figure. He wasn't this sort of respectable role model, quote-unquote, type figure. And so it's been very difficult to get some form of official redemption for him, but we're still working on it.
And we are still working on it. And finally, I think that one of the most astute observers of how this affected the world politic of that time was this great quote you have in there from Ho Chi Minh.
Oh, absolutely.
After the Siki, we can try Siki in a minute, and the Siki Carpentier, excuse me, a boxing match. But he was so astute, Ho Chi Minh, who later became president of Vietnam, obviously, and leader of the revolutionary movement there in France, of understanding what this meant. I'm glad you included that in the book.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is that, you know, typically historians don't, and I'm using historian with a capital H, so professional historians don't really pay attention to boxing matches as, you know, as making a difference in things like policy or politics. But in fact, you know, somebody like Ho Chi Minh, and then also somebody who's a little less well-known, like Claude McKay, who was a writer during the Harlem Renaissance, very much recognized that this fight over symbols in the boxing ring actually meant a lot in terms of the larger anti-colonial and black freedom struggle, and that, you know, even if it didn't directly change anything, that what it did was it gave people hope, it gave them a rallying point to continue to resist. And it also put the very hypocrisy of white supremacy right out there on the world stage in a way that was undeniable.
Well, Teresa Runciteller, this was an amazing book, I'm going to tell you that, and Jack Johnson, Rebel Sojourner, Boxing in the Shadow of the Global Color Line. And it's as someone who covers race and racism and race issues a lot over the last 20 years, and as an old former boxer, both. I
didn't know you were an old former boxer. We'll have to talk about that some other time.
I deeply appreciate this book. This is an amazing piece of history that we really need to wrestle with, and I look forward to seeing what you come up with next.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me on.
Thank you. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.